Silence is one theme that I dwell on in the book, not silence just in terms of meditation or contemplation, but the silence of our lives, the silence of trauma, the silence of our history, the silence of the shame that's linked to our history.
This is Writer's Mosaic in Conversation. John Sadiq talks to the poet Jason Alain-Paysan about the move from poetry into prose, in particular with his new memoir, The Possibility of Tenderness.
Hey there, I'm John Sadiq. Welcome to Writer's Mosaic in Conversation. And I'm really blessed to be in the studio with the wonderful Jason Alain-Paysan. Jason, welcome. Your new book, The Possibility of Tenderness, which is absolutely beautiful, is full of conversations around silence, which is really quite fascinating. Before we get into silence, though, I wanted to ask you, how has the move been for you from poetry into prose?
I didn't want the academic kind of scholarly stuff to guide the way. I wanted the storytelling to be the guide. And then you can do whatever you want afterwards, right? You can put in the kind of factual information, the kind of like thinking information that you want to share with your readers. And I think it's important that erudition is always worn lightly. I like when erudition is soft and kind of not like, you know, being, what's the word for this? Like in your face, or it's kind of like performative. Just to give a concrete example, the history of coffee and how that coffee drinking today, and coffee drinking in the empire, right, when it became like a big thing, connects Jamaica and the West Indies to Britain and to slavery. It's that sort of thing. But anyway, the long and short of it was letting the storytelling guide the way and everything else cluster onto that so that the reader would have a good experience. I'm thinking about the reader. At the same time, I don't want to pander to a reader. And that's very crucial because that's very important as well. I want to challenge the reader as well. And a part of When you do that, what you're doing is you're respecting your reader. I see it as that. You are trusting your reader to embark on a conversation with you. You know, I'm telling different stories about nature, you know. Yes, nature heals you, but also nature is it can be messy. It's hard work, right? If you're talking about farming and so on. There are real people who work the land, right? Who are not just about going on a pastoral walk and kind of like contemplating nature, right? Nature is a thing that it's about earth, it's about connection, you know, in a deeper way than just going for a walk.
I want to just, before we move into that, because I do want to talk about that, it seems to me that you've made a choice, though, on the healing path here. You said this book is written out of not anger.
All right? That's right.
And so a couple of questions on that, if you don't mind, is it seems to me that choice of not anger perhaps may be the route to the book being about healing. But then also I'm really interested in, as an author myself, coping with my own versions of these things, how you brought your creativity to not anger. Can you talk about that internal mechanism or the creative mechanisms a little bit?
It's an interesting grapple that I was doing in that opening chapter, which is one of the last things I wrote in that, within that chapter. I wanted to contextualize the project. I was urged by my editor at the time to do it, but I saw the need, I agreed, because the book sidestepped the typical lens of talking about nature in the UK at the time, which is typically there's a lot of racism and we're angry, right? And there is a lot of racism and we are angry, right? That's true. That's a legitimate sentiment, okay? But what I was doing was to look at our lives through a different narrative, to say it can also be crippling when all that we're allowed as an emotion is anger, when all that our narrative of our life or lives is read through is anger, okay? So you're the angry people or you're the anger people, and that's your only legitimate conversation or discourse or entry into the discourse. I wanted to say we can enter the discourse also through power, through the kinds of empowerment that we live in, that we know, and we need to go back to those.
When you say that's a choice that we have to make.
That was a deliberate choice. So that's why I ground the book through the lens of the empowerment that comes from my people through their relationship with the earth. That's a story as well, right? That's a story that they try to rob from us. And I'm saying, no, I'm recentering that story.
I think that's one of the most important things about the book, quite honestly, that choice is made.
And I don't think it's hard to understand. I'm telling the reader, yes, we are angry, but this particular book is not going to be about that. It's this kind of complexity that we have to inhabit, we have to embrace. And so that's the conversation around what I call non-anger, the right to non-anger, right? So the right for our bodies to thrive, to have peace, to be in that sort of relaxed kind of nervous system where we inhabit our time, our space, whatever. Where do we find that? We have to find that. We have to arrive at that. Those forms of care that come through community. That's why community is so important in the book. Because this community in Jamaica, where I'm from, talking about the community and how the community cares for itself and for each other. But it's also talking about community in the UK, community that I've found, but also the community that all of us need to find around nature for our well-being.
What is the root of that consciousness for you and for our dear listener? How might they find something of that for themselves? Because it sounds impossible if you don't know.
I feel that if I didn't have a community of friends, many of whom are artists as well, where I can just turn up at their door, go sit in their living room, have a chat, or we can just get together and we're always checking in on each other. And these are people who practice a lot of the things I talk about in the book. Let's just say the more than human. They tune into the healing power of herbs. These are spiritual people, are like-minded people to myself. And I have that kind of friend, and I have several of them where I don't need to phone them up to say, I'm coming to your yard. I can just turn up and knock at the door. You know, that kind of people. Mm-hmm. And I think if I didn't have that community around me, I don't know if I'd been able to survive. Mm. Friends like those encourage you and they keep you laughing. They keep you happy. They remind you of joy. I think I also carry something with me that, shall we say, spirit of my grandmother, that I speak about my grandmother in the book, but that sense of power that you carry, that you know that you're connected into a larger universe, that is fundamentally benevolent, I feel. Spirituality is a very significant thing. And I know it takes different forms for different people, but I couldn't have remained grounded to the extent that I am without a certain level of spirituality. And a reminder that in the face of these aggressions coming at you, sometimes left, right, and center, you have a deeper place to go. Right? That's just more powerful than the 3D reality that's around you. So those are the ingredients, I think, that help me.
I just wonder how location and writing and how they fit together for you.
Location influences writing a lot because it influences the texture of writing. Its location is sound. It's the spirit of a place. It's the sound of a place. And so when I'm in Jamaica, I write differently. Probably certain levels, certain qualities of the writing flow better as well. I think location is also the way you see, the way you look. And so that's one quality of the book as well. I found that one of the challenges and the beauties for me was to just be able to talk about certain things by having memory jogged in a way that I wouldn't have been able to talk about them if I'd been over here. Probably it would have been more as nostalgia. But there, I'm able to bring certain realities into literature without, like, I'm speaking from the place, so I'm not speaking to, I'm not translating. That's the word that I'm looking for. Mm. Whereas sometimes you can be tempted to translate because the de facto kind of imaginary reader, well, that's a temptation anyway, to see that reader as a Western reader. That's not gonna understand the language that you're writing about. But if you flip the gaze and you step into that reality, and you're speaking from that reality, learn the wisdom of the people, the knowledge system of the people. I think the beauty is to stop explaining, to just inhabit that. And that's a greater gift to the reader as well, I feel.
I heard your voice very clearly when reading the book. It was literally you, as if we're sitting here right now, telling these stories in a way. So it's really interesting to see both those things, both you removing the projection of the reader and also the dissolution of the implied author.
Mm, fascinating the way you put that. Yes, I did try. I did. It was intentional, my thinking around those things. I'm talking about places that where people don't need to go to the supermarket.
No, and that was amazing to read.
These places literally still exist, but a lot of people, I think, don't know about them, never consider that there are such places. So I wanted to bring in this different reality of land, and like I said, describing these places is also seeing how people talk about land, right? There is an intimacy there that doesn't exist in places like these.
And speaking of intimacy, one of the things that I found really interesting is how at the time you're growing up, more than now, things will have changed now a little bit, as you say in the book, but how unboundaried the land is, and that there's common land, and, you know, people literally are growing their own food and so on. And that is a dream for a lot of people here, but for people of color, people of global majority, you know, it's kind of, I mean, my family are from, well, my dad's side is from India and so on, so that will have been there too, but then it's been kind of colonized and changed and packaged and changed up, and to kind of read about these kind of open landscapes with food growing and Congolin bringing you carrot juice and so on, and things, just that removal of boundary, how that feels in the body is really quite interesting, because I was reading this book with my body, as it were, and you can literally feel, I live in the countryside, I've lived in the countryside for more than a quarter of a century, and I grew up in the countryside, I grew up in a town, but with countryside very nearby, and it would be my escape from racism and the skinheads of the 80s and all this sort of thing. I'd go running off into the, so everything I know has been the hills, but it's always been a sanctuary. But what I noticed is that where I live now, people think it's the most beautiful open space, but actually when you walk through that land, all you're doing is walking through between two narrow walls on a path that you're just about allowed to walk on. Whereas I'm reading your book and it's like you can go anywhere you want, almost, you know? And if you do wander in, you're going to get fed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, almost. You know, there are, you know, property, as I discussed in the book, property does exist in Jamaica as well. There are laws, but because of the history, a lot of properties are common law properties and they're administered differently. So is, you know, the feel of the place is different in the contrapart. And you don't have that level of policing and that, that level of hostility, definitely, about around land. So, yes, it gives you a different feeling, as you say, a different feeling in your body. That's beautiful. That's liberating. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there is globalization is a thing that has affected these local peasant-based communities, as it has communities around the world. But thankfully, they still are able to thrive and survive. And survive. And one of the important things was to be able to shift traditional, accepted, mainstream capitalist discourse around the peasantry, which it has, you know, terms like poverty, backwardness, and such the like, to say, what if we looked at these kinds of spaces and livelihoods? What if we took another gaze? To not have, it's not about creating a dichotomy in the romantic sense of modernity and nostalgia or anything like that. To look at what's positive and affirming about the rural lifestyle, right? The independent food growing lifestyle. And there are several things you can do. One of them is gain lessons for what we can do in our cities, because a lot of us are still going to live in cities, right? You're a writer, I'm a writer, right? But so gain lessons. Secondly, we can look at land in different ways. And a lot of people are already, which is why you get the post-COVID phenomenon of people just land in country areas getting more expensive because a lot of people are wanting to move back. They want a piece of earth to cultivate on their own. This happens in Jamaica as well. So it's not like a dichotomy to say that better, worse, or modernity nostalgia, but it's the kind of way we reframe our thinking around land, around food growing, and about all sorts of that sort of thing. So that was the challenge of the book, alongside this thing that I'm doing around history, showing how a lot of what we take for granted today was built on the backs of, you know, people like me, like my ancestors, and disenfranchising them of land. But also this more, shall we say, contemporary thing of looking at what the land there teaches us today.
We've been talking quite sort of elegiacally, you know, the body and the earth and so on. Just one darker thread I kind of want to lean into is we started out referencing how in your earlier books you talked about silence so much. And silence kind of surfaces again in this book. But this time you're talking about silence as being a cover for shame, for muteness, for trauma, for illegitimacy, and how those are kind of like threaded throughout that landscape as well. So I don't know if there's even a question here, quite honestly.
Yeah, but that's, I'm glad you bring that up, because that's part of what I mean when I say I didn't want to write a nature writing book that's about like stillness and contemplation, right? So I bring in those messier elements. I bring in reality, history and life. And so speaking about silence, it's one theme that I dwell on in the book, not silence just in terms of meditation or contemplation, but the silence of our lives, the silence of trauma, the silence of our history, the silence of the shame that's linked to our history. Because I do talk about history with a big H for us is a history, is involves a history of slavery. That's how I'm Jamaican. That's how a lot of, you know, my ancestors came to that this land as captured people from Africa, brought as slaves to work the land. So the relationship with land does have that complication as well. So from that, you form a thread that goes to my grandmother, and the generations that involve her. Many of them I talk about are women, because it's the women who bear the load in my family, right? I mean, there's a lot to say about the absence of the fathers, but it's the women who are these people who keep the family afloat, who nurture. And so with the kind of history that's behind that, there's a lot of shame. And as I say, the sound of shame is silence. That's one of the meanings, the resonances of silence that I deal in the book. All of what's not said, this thing of you soldier on, you move on, because there's no time to, no ability, really, no vocabulary for really articulating what's driving you, what's behind some of the decisions that you're making. These unspoken things of, you know, where are the fathers? Where is your father, right? These are conversations that don't make it to the dinner table. Yeah. And so, yes, the reader might wonder, how does a conversation around nature connect with that? And that's what, that was the exhilarating, not necessarily exhilarating, but freeing and interesting aspects of writing a nature writing book that could talk about those things.
And perhaps your access as a poet,
yes,
kind of allows you,
yes,
this, because
yeah,
I felt that while you can't actually speak to these things, they exist. They're there in the land, they're there in the quality of the sunlight, they're there in mama tilling the earth, they're there in your mother, you know, the men who are not there. And all this is held in kind of like the ordinariness of the day. And the poet somehow goes, well, I can't get the word, but I'm going to point at it anyway. Or the writer, a good writer, can do this. That's something that I really loved about this, is that it wasn't just the nature book, as it were, you know, and that actually, you know, this is the quality and the contemplation of so many lives, but particularly people of the gold majority, black people and brown people as well. And even though the words may not be there, the recognition of it is deeply significant, and for that to be sitting on the nature shelf is deeply significant as well, I think.
And I'm the first published poet in my family, so I realize that there are clearly some things that probably I'm the first to be able to do. I'm the first to have space and an opportunity to do. So what do you make of that? That's significant as well,
mm-hmm.
Okay? Here's a writer who now lives in England, in the UK, who can publish a book with a major publisher. That's an opportunity to speak, an opportunity to tell a story that is meaningful but would have otherwise gone, you know, it would have lived where it lived. But it's an opportunity to poke beneath the surface and really bring some people back to life, bring some narratives out of the shadows, I would say, to be able to publish a book with Penguin, you know, that gives you a certain level of distribution, that level, and it's coming on the back of the accolades that I've received so far. So it's weird and strange and exciting how the life and the gifts and the work keeps on creating space for itself. And the gifts that you're afforded keep on opening further doors for your story. So right now I'm working on a novel, and this novel is about silence in a way. The protagonist is based on, you know, my grandmother, but it's entirely fictional because it imagines her undisclosed life. The experience of it is like discovering a whole new, different person. I've never published any fiction before, but it's really interesting doing that work, right? Different tools called upon as well. You see what I mean?
Yeah, well, you're literally kind of giving life into the muteness, aren't you? You know, around some of these things. I mean, Mama comes across as a beautiful woman. A very beautiful human being indeed, but she's carrying so much, and the story's not told. A family to be blessed with an author who will then dignify the lives by writing about them with love and tenderness and honesty, you know, even if it is in fiction.
And with the flaws as well.
Absolutely.
Because that's significant as well, you know?
Yeah.
The interesting thing is to get always to the truth of what's driving us, right? And sometimes that's neither a flaw nor a beauty. It's just what is.
No, the complexity of
the complexity is because of the choices that we feel that we have to make at a given time. So that's the character that I'm grappling with now, right? In trying to understand, trying to get into her head, this character that I'd never known before. So yeah, that's the new stage of the work.
Okay, well, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for talking to us, Jason. It was a real privilege. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, John, as ever.
John Sadiq was talking to Jason Alan Pisson. To hear more writers, go to writersmosaic.org.uk.